This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Humaira Aves Shahid spent her early life in Kuwait with her Pakistani family. She grew up having the freedom to walk to the beach alone, pursue her studies, and with no conception that her gender might lessen her worth as a human being. That all changed when she moved to Lahore for school as a teenager. No longer permitted outside alone, she found refuge in Western literature and then pursued the life of a quiet academic. That was not to be. Humaira met and married the scion of one of Pakistan's premier newspapers, became a mother, an editor, and an activist, and she confronted stories of acid attacks on women, the trading of girls to settle tribal disputes, and other abuses. Humaira was eventually seated in the powerful Punjab Regional Assembly, where she challenged corruption, cruelty, usury, and violence against women, girls, and the poor with legislation. Her fight is for laws that may not agree with Pakistan's tribal traditions, but that she believes are true to the message of the Quran. Her new memoir is Devotion and Defiance and was written with Kelly Horan. And Humaira Aves Shahid joins us now from the BBC in London. Humaira, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, how was it that you escaped such gender disparity growing up? Were your parents especially liberal?
Well, my book is a peep for the Western leader that how the majority of the Muslim families are. I mean, my father and my husband were my supporters. I was celebrated by my father. I was encouraged. Not all fathers are brutal to their daughters. We may have experiences in the lower income groups and lower classes, and the reason is ignorance and poverty and cultural conservatism. But families from middle class and upper middle class and the elites, you'll find women in better conditions, and because of the education, because of the exposure, because of the way my father, the family and my extended family is. Even in my grandfather's, you'll never find somebody who's abusive or who's against having daughters. So this is just a reminder for the Western reader what a normal Muslim family is like.
So your life continued in this other Pakistan, the one that was sort of elite. You shrugged off a couple of marriage proposals, but then met and fell in love with and married Adnan Shahid, the son of one of Pakistan's most respected newspaper publishers, which threw you into this kind of rarefied world of politics discussed over dinner and journalists and powerful players in the Pakistani firmament. How much awareness of life for those less privileged, that other reality, did you have at that point?
I was coming from a very protected environment. The male members I was surrounded by, I was loved by them. I've always seen encouragement. And when I got married to this media family, the family had similar values. I mean, my father-in-law had always encouraged me to, you know, show my potential, to be who I am, to speak out. And I was very outspoken from the beginning. What I never thought was how the downtrodden people lived. I'd heard about that. I'd read about that. But I had never encountered such violent, first-hand experience of violence and brutality that I came across when I was doing these stories on women, women victims. It just transformed me. It made me grateful the kind of life I had, but it also made me guilty of how people like me are not contributing and towards people who are underprivileged, how it is a social responsibility of the community to protect others, to provide for others, to take care of the others. And I think that kind of responsibility and that kind of awareness changed me forever, because repeatedly when I encountered resistance in the parliament and I was criticized, I knew that I had made a promise to those women, even if they didn't know about it. I was reminded of what they went through. It is my moral and social responsibility to do what I'm doing today.
Well, you and so many other people were shielded from the truth until you took over what were called the women's pages for one of the newspapers, and later the helpline, another section of the paper. Now, give us a sense of what those respective sections were like before you started editing them and what kind of stories you did eventually cover.
Well, those pages were full of what to buy, how to look, fashion, and entertainment, a lot of frivolous things, which I thought was a waste of space. Not that I'm against the entertainment side of the news pages, but I thought in a country where women had such hardships and where women were such had such a marginal representation and a marginal role, it is my responsibility as a female journalist to sensitize people on the issues of exploitation and violence against women. And we must have a solution base. So I usually used to invite women who were distinguished in their own ways, you know, ministers or lawyers and educators, to bring forward a serious, a profound image of women. I wanted those pages to carry human rights stories. You see, reading about rape and meeting a real victim of rape, is this, there's a lot of difference in that. And I wanted to the women, the readers of my newspaper, to probe into the issues of minors and poverty and violence.
And at the same time, women reporters couldn't even go to places to cover some of these issues, you know, where the prostitutes were living in, or eunuchs, for example.
You see, that was the reason, not because that we didn't encourage that. It was because some female reporters were coming from very conservative backgrounds. And we did not want to encourage any conflict with their families. And when we did have an alternate of a male reporter accompanying them, or you know, and asking a male reporter to do that. So there were, I had a couple of female reporters who were very bold and very courageous, and they did these stories, while there were others who were timid and had issues with their families.
Well, there are so many stories of women violated by husbands or in-laws or suitors who didn't get their way, or they got no help from the police or the courts, certainly. You share so many of these stories in the book. One memorable one comes to me when you and your husband are visiting Multan. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
Multan. And you meet a poor old man. He's got a 15-year-old daughter, Parveen, who was captured and violated, and I'm presuming raped, by his son-in-law. Mm. Now, he thought he was owed a wife. He had married one of the man's daughters, and she died, so he thought he was owed a wife. So he appeals to you, who by that time had been, you know, very well known for the helpline. And you, a woman, are allowed to attend the tribal council, where they come up with a solution. Can you bring us back to that scene and how they resolved it?
Well, it is one of the stories that still shakes me. A father ends up marrying his daughter to the rapist, and he says, and one of the reasons that he gives to me was that because his daughter is dishonored, no man will accept her in marriage, and he was worried about what would happen once he's gone and he's dead, and where would he leave his daughter? The second thing is how the social norms around you, the whole idea of social acceptability, is so important to these rural families for survival. I think I'd never experienced that. I've never, before that, village councils, I'd seen them, but I'd never been sat through the proceedings. So it was for me a very different experience, and I entered the scene with anger and frustration, and I will not let them do this. And I came back despondent, realizing how grave the context was, how chained the people were. And beyond a point, I'm not able to help them because I just cannot interfere beyond a point. And for them, that village council, their tribal values, their social values, and their tribal affiliations were much more important than what that little girl had gone through and why she was forced to get married to the rapist. So it is one of the experiences that horrify me even today.
Mm. Well, you point out that in many of these tribal councils, there aren't very many people who can read, and people haven't actually read the Quran, yet many of them invoke the Quran in defense of inhumane treatment of women and girls. How is this different from your faith, your view of Islam as dictated by the Quran?
I believe that the kind of Islam that we have in Pakistan is puritanic version of Islam. Sharia is chosen out of context and is primarily reduced to the sexual morality of women. It is reduced to the how women dress up and their demeanors. I believe that the more I drenched into my religion, the more I spoke to the religious scholars, I realized 70% of Sharia is about economic matters. It is about your business contracts. It is about social welfare, your contribution to the community, to the society. It is your duty to take care and contribute to the welfare of a common man. Nobody talks about that aspect of Sharia. Nobody talks about the kind of social welfare model we had. Nobody talks about how the rich contributed to sustain the poor. Recently, and I believe in the last few decades, Islam has been reduced to women and their behavior, and it has become extremely judgmental, and I totally disagree with that. Islam is not obsessed about women. Let's talk about 1,000 Arabian Nights, the kind of literature that celebrated women, that was sensuous, that was aesthetic. I mean, look at the Mughal paintings. The Mughal art and the kind of poetry we have had in the subcontinent, this misogynism, this over-obsession with the morality of women is a recent phenomenon in our countries.
We're talking with Humaira Aves Shahid. She's a working journalist, an activist, and a former legislator in Pakistan, one of few. She's been threatened, ridiculed, had her microphone cut off mid-sentence for demanding humane treatment of women and girls, and advocates against what she calls political Islam in a new memoir called Devotion and Defiance. Well, Humaira, in 2002, you were chosen for a seat in the reserved women's section of the Punjab Provisional Assembly. You were jeered, you were catcalled when you stood to defend or legislate for people who'd been abused, still pushed forward. I'm curious about what it is with you. After all these stories we get about women abused and even people at your father-in-law's dinner table kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, this is just how it goes. What is it in you that just could not abide in this kind of treatment?
Well, one of the things the people in my family said that this is something that the police should do, and you're not the police, you're just a journalist, you're just responsible of bringing that to the eyes of the public, not beyond that. And I think the activist streak in me was very strong since the beginning. I'm not here to make a career. I was not there to have bylines. I was not there to, to carve something else. I was there because I was moved by those people. I felt a moral responsibility towards those women. And when I got the opportunity and a position in the parliament, I was haunted by what I had experienced. And I would have never forgiven myself if I wasn't able to bring those forward. And even today, I do all this because, not for others, I do it for myself. Because I don't want an amputated spirit. I want to, this strengthens my spirit. It gives me courage. It takes me transcend this worldly, mundane selfishness that we have in our existence. I think all these experiences have been a source of spiritual evolution for me.
Humaira, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure indeed.
Humaira Aves Shahid, she and the writer Kelly Horan together wrote Devotion and Defiance. Reviews and more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.